You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
This episode of On Brand is brought to you by my new book, Brand Now, How to Stand Out in a Crowded, Distracted World. Many former On Brand guests are already raving about Brand Now. Jay Baer calls it the quintessential guide to modern branding. Stacey Grissom of BarkBox says Brand Now provides practical tools and a helpful framework for building a brand both online and off. Learn more, get special extras and additional resources at brandnowbook.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is John Kolko. John is the author of Creative Clarity, partner at Modernist Studio, and the founder of Austin Center for Design. Previously the Vice President of Design at Blackboard, he has worked extensively with both startups and Fortune 500 companies. He has been a professor of interaction and industrial design at the Savannah College of Art and Design and has taught at the University of Texas at Austin, the Center for Design Studies of Monterrey, Mexico, and Malmo University, Sweden. John, welcome to On Brand.
Nick, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate being invited.
Boy, you know, it's a short bio that has all of my favorite things. It has design, it has some higher ed, but right there at the end, I realized while going through that list, you have some of my favorite places on earth in your teaching CV there. Huge fan of Austin, Texas, and a huge fan of Malmo, Sweden.
I've enjoyed my experiences at all of those places. I spent about 5 weeks in Sweden, actually, and somehow I managed to catch probably the worst weather of all time. And ironically, all of the people that were local were talking about how wonderful it was. So I suppose there's a difference between living in Texas and living in Sweden. But I also enjoyed my experiences there, and it's been fun to juxtapose teaching in the United States in a variety of places as well as in different countries.
Well, as a fellow educator, I'm curious about that. What have you found in the classroom here versus international classrooms?
You know, I think the difference between international classrooms and local could probably be summed up in two different perspectives. One is the students. I mean, to put it bluntly, students in the U.S. are lazy. You know, and by juxtaposition, the students in Sweden are incredibly committed and motivated. They want to be there. You can tell that they're going to throw themselves at the work. And I'm not sure where that comes from. I mean, we can blame, you know, high school or lower education for that. But that was something that was sort of remarkable to me. The other thing that I've noticed is that in Europe particularly, as well as in the various sort of progressive countries over there, they just respect design. There's sort of like an implicit understanding that the world should be well designed for people and that technology or business should come second, but a human experience should come first.
I love that. That's a really good summary of what I like about spending time in the Nordics. And I feel like I give a less eloquent overview than what you just did, but it is the respect of design. We were joking earlier. I'm not a designer by trade, but I like to think of myself as a design-minded person or design-adjacent. But I do appreciate that focus, but also the application seems to be very stark, very simple, but somehow stark, simple, and warm. Usually when we do stark and simple over here, it seems to end up cold. I think. I don't know exactly how that happens, but it all seems very warm and homey, or cozy, as the Swedes would say.
Yeah, I mean, not to give a history lesson, because that will bore everyone. But the background of sort of craftsmanship and really appreciating things like fine furniture and fine architecture that come from, the Finland and Denmark and so on, sort of permeates the culture. So then when you actually start talking about design strategy and the way that companies can leverage design at a more sort of intellectual level, those same sensibilities come across. And there we obviously don't mean aesthetics. We mean something, more process oriented or around this quote unquote design thinking thing. But they seem to take to the idea of detail and craftsmanship and roll up your sleeves until the job is done. And that's something that, I've learned over the years, observing other countries and the way that they appreciate design. It's also a trend that I'm starting to see in the U.S. And I think it's because large companies, the Fortune 100, are starting to realize that design is actually integral to the business. It's not something extra. It's not a veneer on top of something. It actually has intellectual depth.
Well, and that seems like a difference as we kind of come, back to industry and back to the States a little bit. That does seem to stand in contrast is that I think a stigma that design has over here is obviously embraced, as you were saying, by leaders. But I think what many miss is they do think of it as kind of an extra, as the window dressing, as opposed to what you were talking about, that Danish, Swedish, Finnish sensibility. It's really kind of the ultimate intersection of bit of an eye roll, but of form and function, of design being integral to the overall experience instead of a kind of added bonus if you get everything else right.
Something that I'm starting to observe in U.S. companies is they're starting to embrace more than form and function, but also emotion, and this idea that an experience needs to resonate on an emotional level and sort of, tear at our hearts or, it be felt through our whole body. And one of the examples that I like to think of is Disney. Disney has reinvented their park to embrace digital, but the digital doesn't feel tacked on as sort of this technological thing that has an aesthetic veneer on top of it. Instead, it permeates the park. I don't know if you've been there recently, but there's a wristband. Some of the folks at Frog Design worked on that when I was there, and that wristband unlocks a magical experience at the park, almost so you don't notice that you're wearing it. And so it doesn't become, a piece of, just form and function, but it actually becomes the experience that you've had as you go through that magic kingdom.
Well, and I mean, that's a perfect example too, because what Disney is in the business of is, I mean, that's when I talk about what the Disney brand is. I say it's not theme parks, it's not movies and entertainment, it is delivering magical experiences. And almost word for word, you talked about this design function unlocking and really amplifying that experience at a whole new level.
I think when I talk to, some of my clients, they look at companies like Disney and they say, well, how can I emulate that new level that you talk about? We want to be like Disney or Apple or, Nike or pick your brand du jour, but we just don't know how to do it. And a lot of what I found myself doing at my agency is not just doing design work, but also training companies in how they can embrace some of the core pillars of that creativity that I think leads to that sort of magic, almost like immersive experience that people have.
So you talk about the core pillars, and I think that is interesting, because I think another stereotype we have of design, probably related to the previous stereotype of it's something extra, we're kind of caught in the tactics of, oh, once I know something, then we'll design it. So what are those core pillars? What does that look like?
I think that there's a lot of them, but the ones that I always come back to, there's two actually. One is on this idea of vision and narrative, and then the other is this idea of criticism and iteration. On the idea of narrative, I think when we look at design leaders and really abstract them, when we look at anyone who's creative, a business leader, a brand leader, a technology leader, they're able to paint a picture of the world as it could be. They're able to generate enthusiasm and groundswell around a vision of the future and then persuade people that we want to go achieve that vision. And a lot of that comes through storytelling, being a charismatic storyteller. Some of what designers do is they literally make those stories come alive through video and through storyboards and comics. And that, that creates a sort of culture that people want to be a part of. The other big pillar that I see that's common to these types of successful creative companies is around the idea of criticism. And that within these companies, there's a culture of being able to say that is bad. And hearing that is bad. And that goes all the way up and down the chain. It's being able to tell a leader that what they're doing is not a good idea or what they've made is not good. And so the culture is not one of negativity and pessimism, but instead it's one of growth. Because out of that is bad comes a new iteration that, ideally is better. And then over time it gets better and better, again, through that culture of criticism.
Well, and that's, again, there's so many cultural intricacies here, because on one hand you'd think we're blunt Americans, we would be good at that, but I think there's some important differences there, because I think we have brash people, we have bossy people, but maybe this is extra easy for me to see because I'm from the passive aggressive Midwest. But we don't always know how to criticize in a constructive way, not in a hurtful way. So that either leads to kind of, being loud and maybe sometimes hurtful, or not saying anything at all, as opposed to that very practical middle ground that you just identified of, for practical reasons, saying that won't work, here's why. And then I like that you have it paired with criticism and iteration, because it's grounded in why it won't accomplish what we need it to accomplish, and theoretically what we can do to make that better too.
You're dead on. The idea of trust becomes so integral to the idea of criticism. And just fundamentally, if you have a team that doesn't trust one another, then, any form of criticism, whether it's well-intentioned or not, is going to fall on sort of flat, dead ears. And so like a big part of criticism is realizing that a critique is aimed at a work product. It's not aimed at a person. And that gets a little difficult when you talk about any creative staff, because they've infused themselves into what they make. Ultimately that's what makes a good, creative person creative, is that they're full of passion and enthusiasm, and they embed that in the artifacts or the content that they make. And so it takes explicit training and I think an explicit approach to this culture to build that trust. One of the things I do with my teams that's been super successful is I borrow something called a critique from art. And a critique in an art school, everyone puts their work on the wall, they stand back, and they have a conversation around what isn't good about it. And then they talk about what could be improved. But it's a formal meeting. It's not sort of this ad hoc, hey, I came by and I didn't like that. There's this phenomenon in design agencies called a swoop and poop, where the creative director, flies in and says that sucks and then leaves.
Right.
That's not healthy. But instead, during a critique, we learn and we talk about what language to use in order to emphasize that it's about the work and that it's not about the people.
So is there, I'm very curious, because I also, beyond branding and marketing, I also teach communication. So the language is interesting to me. How do you steer someone in the right direction? Because I love the swoop and poop on the agency side of things. Being on the consulting side of things, I've heard of seagull consultants, which fly in, shit on you, and then fly back out.
Birds of a feather. I think they're one and the same. So let me maybe talk through some of the rules of that critique that I institute with my teams. First, we say that there are rules. We just acknowledge up front that a critique is not an ad hoc meeting. It's a very specific form of meeting. And one of those rules is that the person who made a thing presents that thing, but then they don't defend it. They sit back and for the most part, they're silent. You know, they can clarify, if somebody doesn't understand stuff. But the minute they start saying things like, well, this is what I meant, or this is what I intended, they're on a defensive stance. And that creates a response from the critiquer that says, well, now I need to dig in, or even worse, I need to back off. And so one of the rules we have is that the person being critiqued just shuts up. They take notes. They try to capture what was said, and then later they analyze what happened. And just because it was said in the critique doesn't mean they have to go do it. I think a big part of that then, the sort of second rule is that they get to then filter what was said and decide what's relevant and salient and what they want to ignore. And that means people are heard, but then they're sort of very analytically considered in terms of what the designer was trying to do. On the critiquer side, we talk a lot about the language being, aimed at the work product. Instead of saying things like "you did this" or "you did that," talk about the work itself. This area of the work could be improved in the following ways. This part isn't working because it doesn't fulfill the business requirements or the user needs. And I think the last bit of this critique rules is that it has to work across the business. This can't just be a thing that the designer is engaged in. Ideally, criticism is going all throughout in product management, in brand management, apply this in legal context. What would it mean for, the legal team to sort of figuratively pin up what they've made and encourage open discourse and feedback around it? That's the type of cultural change that builds that trust.
I love those rules, and as many as were about language, a lot of them are about interpersonal communication that I was trying to think of how to qualify it. Is it relationship specific? But I mean, it's just good rules for talking to another person, like letting them finish and your person critique shuts up. And then you're listening to people then too. So I think it's the little things.
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, the joke, which is not very funny, is that creative direction is a lot like therapy. you're the one that's there to hear, and sometimes you're there to, babysit and give hugs. But a critique is not a hug, and I think a big part of that is encouraging your team that when they want a hug, to ask for it. If they're looking for accolades and they're looking for somebody to tell them they did a great job, then say, "I'm looking for somebody to tell me I did a good job." And when I reflect a little bit, not to overshare, but on my personal life, this is what a marriage counselor does, right? They teach partners to share what's on their mind and to be direct and explicit. So it is very much like therapy, and it is really about being a good person.
Well, I think that's an interesting role that consultants and agency types do end up playing. I sometimes joke after a meeting that we just finished up with some business therapy there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If people hear that, I think that's great. And that also speaks to the culture of the business, because in some very sort of analytical, conservative industries, there's no room for that. Business should be a very logical, a straightforward, buttoned up activity. Some contexts I really want that. I don't want people, talking about their feelings and fuzziness when they're building jet engines or, when they're working through medicine. But a lot of things like the constructed world around us does have room for that. And a lot of that sort of emotional growth, this fuzziness that's sometimes hard to talk about, is ultimately what infuses the magic into the products and services that we build.
So if someone is trying to get at how to embrace design more in their business, in their brand, what's a good point of entry?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm actually observing a lot of my clients have that specific ask. They say, I want this design thing. I have an organization of, thousands of people. What do I do? And I can give you some of the tactics and then some of the trade-offs of those. One thing that I've seen a lot of is, well, let's run a one-day workshop and get as many people through the process as possible. And I think that's a really good way of giving people sort of the high-level language of what design is. But obviously, you can't learn to do anything in a day. I've seen sort of the next step up from that to institutionalize training sessions For smaller groups of perhaps experienced owners or product managers that last a week or 2 weeks. And, you know, those are a little bit more effective in learning the vocabulary and the processes. But we've been most successful in helping organizations transform by riding alongside of teams, acting as creative directors on actual shipping products, but then doing training, doing teaching alongside. And so rather than it being a consulting engagement where, you know, we have activities and deliverables and we go away and we come back and unveil something, we immerse ourselves in the team. And every time there's a teaching moment, we do it. We teach. And we make it explicit. Hey, we're about to have a little mini workshop to talk about contextual research or synthesis or ideation or, you know, prototyping. And, you know, you fall back on your training and teaching, Nick, a lot, because if you're teaching at a at an institutional level, you understand the benefits of in-context training alongside of the experience of producing something as compared to sort of this, you know, abstract or agnostic type of teaching. And so that's really what we try to drive.
It is interesting because being someone that works in the field but also teaches, you know, I think I was brought in as a teacher because of my work in the field, but I also now feel like if I have to describe myself in the if I can't use the, you know, hyphenate of the, you know, million different things that I am, that I do, I feel like teaching is the one that kind of supersedes them all, because I feel like in the books that I write, they're about helping people do something. The talks that I give, obviously the college teaching is that. But the work with clients, I do feel like continually that teaching is playing a bigger role, especially with tackling some of these big moves, these big issues related to brand, related to design, at this kind of very strange inflection point that we find ourselves at.
Yeah, I agree. I find myself teaching clients an awful lot, primarily because they've, you know, perhaps seen a TED talk or, you know, some 10 or 11 minute vision thing that has got them all jazzed about what design strategy is. But that's it. That's the short and the, you know, the start and the end of it. And so, you know, helping them understand this is what an investment would look like, and therefore, this is what the commitment's going to be, I think is really important. On the flip side of that, I found myself learning a great deal through this teaching, and by working with clients and understanding their expectations around design. Because a lot of that starts to have me question, well, where did they hear that and why do they think that? You know, what's led them to think that design thinking or, you know, moving post-it notes on a wall or whatever it is actually going to impact their revenue? How can I work through that lens to help them see that, you know, you have a part of the picture. You're absolutely right, but you're also absolutely wrong. And let's work together to leverage your tacit knowledge of your business and my expertise in creative fields to really start to come to, you know, a strong marriage.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that it is interesting to then take that back into the college classroom, because I think that understanding what's actually important to businesses as well is sometimes missed in academia.
Oh, you're totally right. One of my early
he
jobs.
Says gingerly while yeah, continuing right. to be partially gainfully employed from.
Yeah, that's right. You don't want to get fired for this. Maybe they won't hear you. One of my first jobs when I was about 22 or 23 was actually teaching at the Savannah College of Art and Design, which you mentioned. And you know, when you're a 22-year-old, you sort of look like the students. As an aside, I remember I would wear a tie to teach, not because I had to, but because it differentiated right, me from right. the undergrad. But a big part of that teaching experience was for me learning and really sort of thinking about how can I package what I know to be true, what I'm starting to build that tacit understanding or automate a sort of autotelic knowledge around. How can I package that in a way that anybody else can understand it? And really coming to terms with the fact that there is no one way. that, you know, I can present things in 100 different ways and that student isn't getting it. And you know, unlike in a client context, I can't say, well, that client's dumb to the student. I can't say the student's dumb.
It's frowned
upon.
Whole
point. That's the whole reason they're there is because they're dumb and they're trying to learn. And so that puts the onus on me to sort of recast and reteach over and over and over to help them learn.
That is awesome. Well, I hate to do this because I'm loving this conversation, but believe it or not, it is time for me to chat about a brand that has made you smile recently.
Well, I'll denigrate a different brand, and then I'll give you the smiling one. My wife and I bought a new washer dryer from Home Depot, and we just had the most miserable experience possible, primarily due to their supply chain and their distributors. Because once you buy it, Home Depot sort of washes their hands of it. And you get this third-party delivery service that works with another third-party delivery service. And ultimately, the people showing up at your house have nothing to do with Home Depot. And so, you know, I ended up writing one of these escalation letters to executives that got no response to speak of, talking about my shitty experience. But, you know, we'll compare that with Lowe's, which is where we ultimately ended up buying our washer dryer from. And, you know, I'll cross my fingers because, in fact, it shows up tomorrow. But the process so far has been fantastic. You know, they called me, we worked on the phone together, they explained the process in detail, and so I'm very well prepared for what's going to happen. You know, again, cross my fingers, it might all go to hell. But when I juxtapose the two experiences, it really is about emotion. It's about some of what we were talking about before, because at the end of the day, it's the same washer dryer. And so the experience is really about how I feel with my interactions with that brand.
That is great, and here's to hoping that the new appliance install goes as planned.
Thank you, Nick.
John, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Well, there's two places. One is at my personal website, which is johnkolko.com. And the other is at my company, Modernist Studio, which focuses on design strategy and helping companies do all of the different things that we've talked about. And that's moderniststudio.com.
That is perfect. We will link up to all of that in our show notes. John, thank you for joining us on Brand.
Thank you, Nick. I appreciate it.
And a reminder, if you heard something that you liked on this episode or another, or if you have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, let me know using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. OnBrand is a production of Brand Driven Digital, helping complex organizations simplify their branding and marketing to unlock growth. More, including the links we discussed on this episode, at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.